True presents Mantra, Sacred Words of Power, Session 11, Tibetan Buddhist Mantras.
In an earlier session in this class, I discussed Buddhism in general. Among the various branches of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism has the most reliance upon mantra. And we find a variety of forms that we'll discuss there, and mantras for a variety of purposes. Until the late 600s, the religion in Tibet was Bon Po. It was a form of almost sorcery that used ritual power and spirits from the mountains. And as almost the state religion, Bon Po was extremely influential in the courts of the kings. Well, when the Turfan dynasty came to power in the mid-700s, they began to look at Buddhism because they were exposed to it by trade with the South. And the more they examined Buddhism, the more they became interested in it because Buddhism was not concerned with political power as the Bons were. So, feeling this might be a good religion to bring into their country, they asked popular Buddhist teacher Satan Raksita to come from Nepal into Tibet and to begin to teach. He accepted the invitation and began to teach Buddhism and its doctrine of self-reliance. And this very much upset the Bon priests. And they began to fight back with their own ceremonies and their own semi-forms of mantra. They were not based in Sanskrit, but they had ritual power and they were successful. And Buddhism retreated and was largely beaten back over the next 100 years. Finally, a ruling member of the dynasty decided that they needed help. And through messengers that were sent out to the south, they put out a call. We need help. Buddhism here is a wonderful religion, but it is being beat by the Bon sorcerers. Who will help us? Now, according to what records we have, no one wanted to come and do battle with the Bon priests. They were very much respectful of the abilities of the Bon priests, and most of those who heard the call said thank you, but no thank you. The exception, of course, was the legendary Indian master Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava was a tantric master, and as we talked about earlier, that means that he was able to work with the energy of nature, the very forces of this universe. So it is said that he heard about the call and answered with great relish and traveled northward. And there's a story about his coming to the court, which probably is apocryphal, but it's a good story anyway and makes a good point. The story goes that Padmasambhava arrived at the court of the king, and he was sitting elevated on a dais, sitting in an ornate chair, surrounded by the priests of the Bon Po religion. And after some prompting by these priests, the king pointed his finger at him and said, "You should bow down to me, I am the king." Whereupon Padmasambhava pointed at the king and said, "No, it is you who should bow down to me." And fire came out of Padmasambhava's finger and singed the sleeve of the robe of the Tibetan king. Whereupon, seeing the smoldering mess, the king of Tibet said, "I see what you mean." From that point, Padmasambhava began to combat the Bon priests one by one. He knew well the secrets of mantra and the ritual worship, puja and yajna, the fire ceremony. And so one by one, he defeated the Bon priests. His knowledge was far superior to theirs. And when he would defeat one of the deities of the Bon Po religion, he would proclaim that this deity had now been converted to Buddhism and was now a defender of Buddhism. And then they would have a grand ceremony welcoming this new deity to Buddhism. Well, people in the country began to flock to Buddhism. Satan Raksita was invited back to the kingdom. He'd been driven out. And together, he and Padmasambhava established Buddhism in Tibet, built monasteries, and began spreading the teachings far and wide. The first thing we should remember, then, is that without the esoteric knowledge of Padmasambhava, without his understanding of the power of Sanskrit mantra, and its ability to combat the Banpo priests, it's quite probable that Buddhism would not exist as we know it in Tibet. The Banpo priests did have some understanding of the esoteric forces, and Satan Raksita, although a wonderful philosopher, did not use mantra, did not use puja, and did not have these resources to combat the Banpo sorcerers in their own way. So it took a combination of the understanding of the esoteric forces through Padmasambhava, as well as the beautiful intellectual precepts of Satan Raksita. Now it went back and forth for the next 100 years or so. After Padmasambhava and Satan Raksita passed, sometimes the Banpo would make a little progress and then they would be beaten back, and then they would make a little progress and then they would be beaten back. But out of that came somewhat of a fusion between Banpo religion and Buddhism and the tantric practices of Padmasambhava. So that in some of the esoteric rituals, although not all, you will still find uses of certain ceremonial daggers and skulls and other implements that you will not find in the ritual worship called puja in the South. With that as a background, we'll move on to how the representation of power and use is portrayed. Many of the deities are shown in a combination of masculine and feminine that they call yub-yum, yub-yum. And in this configuration, the masculine is compassion. Now, this is not empty compassion. This is not sit in your chair and do nothing compassion. This is a dynamic compassion, a compassion that has force behind it. And the feminine aspect is called the wisdom. Similarly, this wisdom is not sit with your eyes closed and understand, but a wisdom that emanates as a force from the person. And the combination of the dynamic compassion and the dynamic wisdom make one a Buddha with the power to act. Scripturally, there are many, many, many Tibetan scriptures. Some have been passed down, and some have arisen out of the teachings of the great practitioners like Milarepa. It's an interesting thing. The monasteries control the teaching of the precepts of Buddhism. And the monasteries are pretty tightly controlled. That is, they were until the Chinese interceded, as we all know. But in historical Tibet, the monasteries were structured and the teachings were taught in almost the same way, generation after generation. This is the way it is in most educational systems, including the West. But because this is a spiritual institution, something interesting would happen. Every 100 years or so, some towering spiritual intellect among them would write a completely new interpretation of the scriptures, or take some small portion of scripture and expand it in a new and exciting way, and a way which confounded the conventions of the time and were then adopted. So that rather than having a set of teachings that remained exactly the same over hundreds and hundreds of years, the teachings of Tibetan Buddhism were dynamic. It's almost as if every 100 years or so, some new being would come in and stir the pot in a way that kept it fresh, intellectually vigorous, and new. Now that we have some common understanding of an historical background of Tibetan Buddhism, let's look at the various deities and anthropomorphized principles to which some of the mantras become attached and what they do. One of the deities is called Mahabhairava. This is a fearful guarding deity with 9 heads, and one of them is an ox with blue horns. And this is a defender of Buddhism. And Bhairava is common to both Hinduism and Buddhism, and there are long mantras associated with both, which I won't cover here, but its importance is that it is a fusion of Indian Tantrism, Banpo, and Buddhism. One of the more important deities of Tibetan Buddhism is Vajrapani, the great initiator. Now, Vajrapani has 2 aspects, as many of the Tibetan deities do, one which is beautiful to behold, and one which is terrible and horrible to drive off any who would attack the followers of Buddhism. But as a peaceful, beautiful figure, dark blue in color, indigo according to some, but mostly portrayed as dark blue, Vajrapani sits holding the vajra, and he initiates one into the mysteries of Tibetan Buddhism. A vajra is a small metal implement that looks on both ends like it has fingers of metal which have been closed. If you were to take a hand and join all the fingers extended, you would have what the vajra looks like on both ends, and in the middle it has a solid ball. So this is an instrument of power, also called a thunderbolt, that is used in their rituals. As Vajrapani holds it, it is an instrument of power and an instrument of initiation. Although there are several mantras associated with Vajrapani, the easiest and a very powerful mantra is quite simple. It is Hung, that's Hung, Vajra, Pei. Hung, Vajra, Pei. I'll chant it a few times. Hung Vajra Pei, 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 Hung Vajra Pei. Hung is a variation of the seed sound hum that we previously learned. In this case, it moves from M in the front of the throat to ung in the back of the throat. It has, over time, the same effect by a slightly different root. Vajra is that instrument that we just described, called a thunderbolt or an implement of power. Pei is the Tibetan pronunciation of a Sanskrit word spelled P-H-A-T and in Sanskrit pronounced phat, phat. Phat means simply a weapon mantra, a weapon mantra. So you will find certain Sanskrit mantras, not covered in this course incidentally, that end with phat, indicating that the mantra is being used as a weapon of spiritual protection. Now, I was initiated into the practice of this mantra by a woman guru from Tibet known as Jetsun Ma. She was a princess initiated from the time she was 8, and in the middle 80s, she was in Los Angeles for some time, where she would visit from her center in Vancouver. I took the Vajrapani initiation from her, and some time later began to occasionally chant Hung Vajra Pei, Hung Vajra Pei, Hung Vajra Pei, Hung Vajra Pei. Well, one Saturday, I decided to tackle the garage. Garages sometimes tend to accumulate large boxes and piles of various assorted things, and my garage was no different. For some reason, I decided that the mantra for my garage cleaning would be Hung Vajra Pei, Hung Vajra Pei. So for the next 4 hours, as I'm sorting through, throwing things away, rearranging, stacking, I'm chanting Hung Vajra Pei, Hung Vajra Pei, Hung Vajra Pei. Finally, it was finished, and I went back inside and did some more errands around the house, and then I realized that I needed something from the garage. I was not chanting anymore. I had finished the cleaning of the garage and stopped chanting as I went back in the house. When I re-entered the garage to get the items that I was looking for, I was greeted by a wave of palpable silence. It was the thick kind you could cut with a knife. I was absolutely shocked. By comparison, the house was noisy, and the garage was absolutely silent. And I realized that somehow by chanting that mantra, bringing the power of Hung Vajra Pei into the garage, whatever background noise from whatever source was gone and replaced by a peaceful and all-filling silence. Well, as you can imagine, I have used that mantra regularly ever since. I will chant it at least 108 times nearly every day many times, many days, much more than that. So I offer it to you in the following categories. If you have no peace in your house, no peace in your room, no peace in your business, if you want to contribute dynamic peace, chant this mantra. You can chant it silently. You can chant it out loud. You can mumble it. Wherever you chant it, you will be making a contribution towards a dynamic and comfortable peace. I suspect, rather than know, that it is an introductory mantra. There is another introductory mantra, but one that is practiced by many Buddhists, called Vajra Sattva. Vajra Sattva. Vajra, as you know, means the thunderbolt, and Sattva means peace, dynamic peace. So here we have the thunderbolt of dynamic peace. Now, the anthropomorphized being, which is Vajrasattva, is shown also in two visages, and we're only going to deal with the peaceful one. White, beautiful face, and they use it in the following manner. Imagine this being sitting 3 or 4 feet above your head. From its heart, a beam of light comes into you. And as you chant the mantra, black gunk comes out of your pores and into the earth, who knows how to recycle the negative energy, as it were. Just like a form of spiritual composting, if you will. So Vajrasattva is purification by skillful means. Vajrasattva mantra has the power of vanquishing negative karma. It has the power of restraining potential negative behavior, and is a powerful antidote to our past karma. Now, there is a 100-syllabled form of the mantra, which is longer than any of the freight train mantras we've talked about so far. So I'm not going to chant the 100-syllabled form. There is a short form, which I have used with great effect, and here it is. Om Vajra Sattva Hung, 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 Om Vajra Sattva Hung. I encourage you to use this mantra and use the visualization practice. If you find that this mantra is very agreeable with you, if you find that you enjoy the practice of saying the mantra, then seek out a qualified teacher of Tibetan Buddhism. And we are fortunate to have many in the country at this period of time. Find a qualified teacher of Tibetan Buddhism and learn more mantras and practices that will expand you in the way that you enjoy using mantras such as Vajra Sattva Hung and Hung Vajra Pe. Another archetype of Tibetan Buddhism is Manjushri. Manjushri. Any of you who have been in a Eastern or an Oriental art store may have seen a small figure holding a sword. The sword indicates that it is probably Manjushri. Now, as in the Vedic approach, Brahma has his consort as Saraswati, his power. In Tibetan Buddhism, they also claim Saraswati. See how popular she is. And she here is the spouse of Manjushri, because he represents the discrimination and discriminating wisdom. And the sword he carries is the power to cut through apparent realities, false concepts, earthly cares into transcendental wisdom. And the power for him to do that is Saraswati. Here is the Manjushri mantra. Om Arapatsana Dhi Dhi Dhi. 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 This mantra will produce in you a heart-centered sense of discrimination, cutting through earthly difficulties from the standpoint of your understanding, so that you begin to see things from a position of wisdom and a position of heart, and not just from a position of desire and want and need. That is why Manjushri is called the archetype of spiritual wisdom, and his sword is his means of cutting through to achieve that wisdom. And the sword of mantra, Om Arapatsana, D, is your sword to become Manjushri. As we talked about in a previous session, the final teaching of the Buddha is reputed to be the Kala Chakra mantra and the Kala Chakra teaching. I won't review that material here, but I will chant the mantra for you. Remember, Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha, Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha, Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha. And you recall that it is reputed to help one to be reborn in Shambhala for the last battle leading to liberation for those who fight in it. It also is a mantra leading to perfection of the divine vehicle and is therefore a Siddha mantra from the Tibetan tradition. The mantra that most of us know from Tibetan Buddhism is the mantra that is most chanted in the entire world. Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum. Now, the Tibetans do not necessarily chant it that way. I was given it that way, so that's the way I chant it. In the spirit of chanting it the way they do, I will chant that for you briefly, and then we'll talk a little bit about the mantra. Many of them pronounce it this way. Omani pe me hung, Omani pe me hung, Omani pe me hung, Omani pe me hung. Om we've talked about. That is the unity at the brow center. That is where all the pairs of opposites are resolved. The seed sound there, Om, is said to be the essence of the Vedas and the essence of the mantra for illumination, the Gayatri Mantra, that we'll talk about in a subsequent session. Mani. Mani here means mind. As such, it is the philosopher's stone. It is consciousness. Now here I'd like to clear up a misconception, if I may. Some people believe that the object of Buddhism is to dissolve into the supreme and thereby sort of disappear and fuse with the great all. That's not entirely correct. As I understand it, the aim is to become completely conscious. Completely conscious. And that consciousness at some point becomes indivisible with the rest of reality. But that does not mean that you have dissolved. You still exist. It is merely mind in a higher state. The Tibetan Buddhists also believe that the body is a creation of mind in the past. And so that the practices of mantra and other Tibetan Buddhist practices are to recreate any false concepts so that you may arrive back at a pristine state of your own mind. Perfection then would make you a Siddha, as we talked before. They call it controller of the elements. And you'll recall we talked about the elements of the chakras, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And so the Tibetan Buddhists also talk about becoming a Siddha. And the word Padme has two meanings. It means manifestation of consciousness in the various chakras in the body, which would make one a Siddha or a perfected one. And it also stands for the lotus at the heart, because there is an underlying teaching that if mind and heart are united, you are truly free and anything is possible, because mind is the conceiver and heart is the great power. That's why they place so much emphasis upon compassion. So part of the purpose of the mantra Omani Padme Hum is to achieve a dynamic fusion of mind and heart. Hum, the final word, is integration between the heart and the mind. As the seed sound of the throat, you'll see that physically within your own body, it lies between the heart and the brain. So it is called the syllable of integration. Here again is the mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. In summary, Om, universality and unity. Mani, luminous, involving mind. Padme, unfolding of knowledge and power in the various chakras and opening of the heart. Hum, integration of all of these into dynamic compassion in action, sometimes called the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara. There is another phrase associated with this mantra. The jewel is in the lotus. That means that the jewel of consciousness is now in the heart's lotus. Well, why wouldn't it be the other way around? Well, it's an interesting thing. The mind is a bit like the moon. You know, it has no light of its own. The moon we see by reflected light from the sun, and the mind has light reflected from the heart. There's an ancient teaching in the East where the spiritual teacher asks the student, when you sleep and when you dream, where comes that light you see to dream by? Interesting. The answer is, it is the light of the soul, which is reflected in the subconscious mind while one is asleep, and in the conscious mind while we are awake. It is the same light, but neither the conscious nor the subconscious have any light of their own. It is all from the heart. Every year, I get together with a few friends in the full moon in Taurus, and we chant this mantra and several others for from 6 to 12 hours. We do it at a ceremony that is called the Wesak Festival, which really is the celebration of the birth and the death and the enlightenment of the Buddha. I became inspired to perform this ceremony every year in the following way. As a priest in a small center in Washington, D.C., I was constantly on the go between working in a job, performing religious ceremonies in the morning and in the evening. My days were usually packed. One day I received a phone call from a friend, Charles, who said, "Have you seen the morning paper?" I had not. He said, "Well, I'll see you tonight at Georgetown University. 7 o'clock. Be there. I'll see you." So after the end of my day, I hopped on a bus and went across town, and the next thing I knew, I was about to enter something called the Black Hat Ceremony by the 16th Galwa Karmapa, head of the Vajrayana branch of Tibetan Buddhism. So I paid my $5 and got my program and was seated in row 7, and I thought, this is great. I've got a view where I can really see what's going on. And after some preliminary chanting from some of the monks and the playing of those long, curved horns, this man in his mid-50s, slightly pot-bellied, strode out on stage and we all applauded. And then he did something very odd. He elevated his gaze about 30 degrees and took in a very deep breath. And I was seized by the thought that somehow he had just breathed all of us in. In any case, then he turned around and mounted a seat which had been placed behind him so that he was about at our shoulder level if you were standing in front of him, and also meant that everyone in the hall could see him quite clearly. And then began the Black Hat Ceremony. Glancing at my program, I could see that it started several hundred years ago when a king had had a dream in which he saw this black material draped around a rigid metal framework and studded with jewels. Upon awakening, he called his craftsmen together, had them construct what he saw in his dream, and then journeyed to the local monastery where the Karmapa was and gave it to him. The Karmapa at that time nodded, placed it upon his head, and began to chant the mantra,
Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum.
And that's how the Black Cat Ceremony was born. So several times a year, the Gyalwa Karmapa will perform this ceremony. By witnessing the ceremony where this is chanted by the Karmapa, his spiritual power will shorten the amount of time necessary for those attending to achieve enlightenment, and will quicken it even more if you should also practice the mantra. So the ceremony began, and after ringing of bells and waving of incense, out came a hatbox from somewhere, and this odd-looking black hat emerged, and the Karmapa placed it upon his head. Thereafter, he took out a small crystal mala, rosary, and began to chant the great Mani mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And the first thing I noticed was that he seemed to drop about 30 years of age. Instead of a guy in his mid-50s, there seemed to be a guy in his late 20s sitting there chanting the mantra. It was extraordinary. It didn't look like the same fellow. And then when he was finished, he put them all away. He was himself again. There was a few more chants and ringing of bells, and the ceremony was over. It really did not take that long. And then a receiving line formed in front of him on, as you're facing the stage, on the left side, and he would go through various stations and then spend a moment with him. I thought, well, isn't that nice? So, because I was in row 7, I was one of the first to get up in the receiving line. And I went through the various stations. At one, you get a little rice, and another, you get a thread, and so forth. And then I came to a donation basket. Now, here I had a problem. I had only enough money with me to take the bus home. And if I gave my money, I would have to walk, and I didn't feel like walking 10 or 12 miles. So I mentally made an agreement, well, I'll just pledge X amount of dollars, and I will send it next month. I made my pledge. The monk who was standing by the bowl smiled and nodded at me. And the thought went through my mind, could he possibly know that I pledged? Because I put nothing in the bowl, but he smiled anyway. Nah, couldn't be so. So then it was my turn to stand before the Karmapa. Now he takes my head, he bends it forward, and he takes a little metal object and places it on the back of my neck. It's slightly warm to the touch. And then brings my head straight up again, smiles at me, shows me a playing card of someone I haven't the faintest idea who, and then it's over, and I'm out of the line and sort of stumbling back on the floor again. Well, I figure it's time to see if I can find Charles. If I can find Charles, I can get a ride home. If I can get a ride home, I can come back and put my bus fare in the donation basket. Sounds like a good deal to me. There is a balcony in the back of the hall. I work my way through, get up on the balcony where I will have a good view and perhaps spot Charles. As I'm standing there looking, all of a sudden, beginning in my chest, is what I call the loudest sound I ever heard that didn't make any noise at all. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, was booming in my chest. It went on for about 30 seconds or a minute. In any case, it seemed like an eternity. And I looked around quickly and realized no one else could hear it. Only I could hear it. Finally, I thought, I wonder. So I went to the front of the balcony, and mentally I shouted at the Karmapa, who's still working with his long line of people snaking around the hall, "Is this you?" Immediately he stopped what he was doing, lifted his head, and grinned at me with a force of joy that practically knocked me off my feet. The pure joy of the grin was all-encompassing, all-captivating, and I stood there with this indescribable feeling and an understanding that he had initiated me into the Om Mani Padme Hum practice. I hadn't asked for it, but here it was. So I practice it every year, not every day, but every year. After the ceremony, I returned home, and I made a pledge that I would begin to observe the Vaisakh, the anniversary of the birth and the death and the enlightenment of the Buddha. But I would do it in a more unusual way. In my travels, I had read about a ceremony that is called the esoteric Vaisakh. I don't know if this is true or not. I can only tell you what I read and what I did. According to what I read, there is a hidden valley in the Himalayas. Now, I can't tell whether this valley is on a subtle plane or actually on the physical plane or somewhere in between. It's not made clear. And in that valley gather on the full moon in Taurus, which is the Vaisakh, people who, from all of the religions, who've contributed to the development spiritually of humanity over the past year. Rabbis and mullahs and ministers and teachers of all kinds and descriptions, irrespective of religious background. And they gather to celebrate this moment. This moment will produce what they call the Great Outpouring. And it is where the Buddha and the Christ work together powerfully for the upliftment of humanity. At the front of this valley is a flat rock with a bowl sitting on top of it, a crystal bowl filled with some kind of liquid. And the Christ presides at the moment of the full moon. He intones a mantram known only to him as the Buddha approaches in a ball of light. As the mantra is spoken, the Buddha releases an emanation of light that travels all over the world, and everyone receives a quickening at that moment. Then the liquid in the bowl is distributed to all who have gathered in the valley, and they drink it, and they go on their way. It's over. Well, I thought to myself, this would be a nice thing to observe in honoring what I had received from the Galwa Karmapa. So in 1975, I scheduled a Vaisakh gathering at the organization where I was. And I selected mantras from several world religions, beginning with the great Jewish mantra, Baruch Ato Adonai Eloheinu Melacha Olam, which salutes the all-powerful God that created heaven and earth. I used Tibetan Buddhist mantras like Vajra Sattva Hung and Hung Vajra Pe and Om Haksa Malavarayam Swaha, the Kala Chakra. I also employ a Kuan Yin mantra from Chinese Buddhism. Namo Kuan Chi Yin Pusa. Namo Kuan Chi Yin Pusa. I often include a Hindu mantra. Om Namah Shivaya. Or, sometimes in addition, Om Aim Saraswat Ye Swaha. And we chant a mala of each of those mantras, and it may take a couple of hours. And then for the rest of the time, from 4 to 10 hours, we chant, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum, Omani Padme Hum. At the front of the ceremony, we always build an altar on which is a little statue of the Buddha, a picture of the Christ, and a crystal bowl which we fill with water. And at the end of the ceremony, like the ceremony in that esoteric valley, we distribute the water around to people. Now, I can tell you, I've had people that have come and stayed for the chanting for several hours that have never attended anything like that before, who have then sipped the water and said, you used carbonated water, didn't you? And the answer is no. The power of the chanting of all of those who gather charges the water spiritually, and then we consume it. This ceremony is powerful in a way that is difficult to describe. And I make it easy for people by saying, come and chant with us. If you have a busy schedule, come and chant for 5 minutes. If you can, chant for a half an hour. If you can stay 2 hours, wonderful. If you can stay longer, that's fantastic. But come, adapt how long you can be here according to your own schedule, but come. And whether they come for 5 minutes or 5 hours, when they're ready to leave, I always dip into the crystal bowl and give them a cup of water so they can have some of the charged water to take with them to help them on their way. So I would encourage you, if you want to be of spiritual service to your own community, schedule your own WISAC. Set it up in a way that's convenient to you, at a time that's convenient to you, at some time of day on the full moon in May. If you have inclination and resources, have a meal afterwards so that you can all sit in community and share food and spiritual conversation. It's a wonderful experience. The Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, as I said earlier, is the most chanted mantra in the world. It will transform you. Over time, it will lift your energy to the heart center and above. It will transform the energy of the lower chakras and transform you individually. Chanted by a large number of people throughout the world, it is a powerful force for good in helping to balance negativity all over the earth. So those who are chanting this mantra are helping all of us. And if you decide to chant it as well, not only will you be helping yourself evolve, but you'll be joining forces with the others who are chanting this mantra that help the whole world. Before we end this session, I'd like to spend a little time talking about gurus and spiritual teachers. The term guru is probably the most misunderstood Sanskrit word common today in the English language. Any kind of teacher who has a public platform is called a guru of this or a guru of that. Classically speaking, the syllables gu and ru mean darkness and that which dispels it. So a guru is a reliever of darkness. Well, darkness of what? Well, it's darkness of the mind. It is the mind that becomes enlightened because the soul and the heart is always in a state of enlightenment. There was never a time it was not. But we, in our everyday existence, live in the world of mind and senses, and it is that a guru can help become enlightened. Now, there are all kinds of gurus. There are some who speak, there are some who sing, there are some who are completely silent. Meher Baba, who reorganized the Sufi order, was silent for 40 years and only wrote by a chalkboard. If you read his three-volume set, Discourses, you will find some of the most powerful spiritual teachings available anywhere. There have been many public figures. Most of us know Paramahamsa Yogananda. The great Shivananda, up in Rishikesh, sat in a single room for 40 years and sent his teachers all over the world, the Integral Yoga Institute, founded by Swami Satchidananda. The Shivananda Yoga Centers, founded by Swami Vishnudevananda. The Divine Life Society in India and in Europe, founded by Swami Chidananda. All of these are students of Swami Shivananda. And there are gurus in almost every tradition. Gurus have specific gifts to give when they come, and they have specific things that they do. Their job, spiritually speaking, is to move souls along in their evolutionary process. They usually come into embodiment with their principal students, who will also help them with the work. Importantly, they can speak not only to the mind and the ego, but also to the soul. A true guru has the ability to take conditions upon themselves to speed the development of their students. I told you earlier how Paramahamsa Yogananda, when he visited a place in India that had elephantiasis, took a portion of it on himself. Now, having said that about gurus, I'm going to turn around and I'm going to say that true gurus are extremely rare, number one, much rarer than we are led to believe. And number two, that the real guru is not a person at all. The real guru, the true guru, is a principle. The Sanskrit name for it is Upa Guru, which means the enlightener without form. So we have the teacher, the enlightener, without form. Well, how can that possibly work? Well, in people of high spiritual development or attainment, that principle grows very strong. But that principle exists in each and every one of us. You know, it is the Upa Guru within that leads us to seek spiritual things in the first place. It is the Upa Guru that leads us from one portion of the path to another. Most of us will have more than one teacher in a lifetime. I've seen people come out of a traditional Christian or Jewish tradition and maybe follow the path of Vedic Hinduism for a while, and then the Native American path for a while, and then perhaps the Tibetan path for a while, and some even return then to their Christian or Jewish roots. But they are never the same as when they started. But along the way, they have had many, many teachers, because the Upa Guru is leading them where they need to go, first to one set of teachings and then to another, building and building, working out karma with various people, as well as learning and assimilating spiritual principles and growing spiritually. This is in contrast to the commonly held idea that one has a guru with whom one spends an entire life, and there are tests and trials. I would suggest to you that this is far rarer than most of us who have many teachers in a lifetime. I'm also concerned with the idea of tests. These tests, in many cases, in my opinion and my experience, are designed to keep a student with a particular teacher. And inevitably, a time arises when a person feels within it's time to go. And the teacher without says, you need to stay. At that very moment, the external teacher becomes an actual hindrance to the student, keeping them from progressing where they need to go. So, honor your teachers, honor your gurus, but know that the greatest ones know that they serve your own guru tattva, your own principle of the guru, which goes by the name Upa Guru, the principle that is everywhere. They serve you, not the other way around. There is a mantra that can help you keep focused and tuned with your own inner guru, your own Upa Guru. And that mantra is, Om Gam Gurubhyo Namaha. Om Gam Gurubhyo Namaha. Om Gam Gurubhyo Namaha. The seed sound Om you know. Gum, you'll recall, is a seed sound for Ganesha in the archetypes. But it is a seed sound for unity within, remember? It produces unity. And when we are unified within, we can accomplish many things. In this case, the seed sound Gum is removing obstacles that exist between your conscious mind and your own Upa Guru within. Gurubhyo Namaha. You are saluting with Namaha, the principle of the Guru, through the mantra. Om Gam Gurubhyo Namaha. Om Gam Gurubhyo Namaha. So if you feel the need to either move to a teacher or move from a teacher, and you're not quite sure, or if you just like to find a good teacher, sit in meditation by one of the methods we have already discussed and chant the mantra, Om Gam Gurubhyo Namaha. May it ever lead you where you need to go, and may you never forget the true Guru lies within you.